Warning. This story includes materials that are classified your ears only due to disturbing content. Other times we are quite silly and really just a hoot. Unless you are cleared for graphic depictions of sex, violence, or dirty words, this never happened. We were never here. It should go without saying that this is not intended for kids, but we're still saying it for their sake and for yours. We don't always play nice. You've been warned.
You've been sent here to locate the hostile personality. Manifestation of the subject's repressed urges. We use a special property of the fissure beneath Blue City called the Lacuna to erase these urges and...
You deserved it.
Everyone is briefed before our mission.
Let's say, hypothetically, you had orders to do something you think is incredibly dangerous and stupid.
But you forgot most of it.
Static. That's about all we know.
You sound lost, Agent. Strange events, meetings with specific personalities and the like are referred to as escalations.
Yes, it's bad.
Like a chess game.
Static is bad. That's what static is.
Unfortunately, we're not sure what the pieces do or how to play in any meaningful capacity.
Badness.
Things can get out of hand fast.
I will make your life intolerably painful.
The conflict. Some kind of ongoing war.
Blue City is beautiful.
Embedded spies.
In the way noir films and dusty cathedrals are beautiful.
A series of bombings.
Even the most colorful things are drab and pasty.
It stays that way.
The sky above.
Passers-by are dressed formally in styles decades behind the time.
Citizens avoid talking about the Spider-Man.
Even the cutting edge of fashion here comprises old suits and dresses.
Once they're on you, there's no shaking them.
Haven't been seen since 1985.
Either you dispatch of the HP or you eject before you end up dead.
Try to document any abnormal experiences, side effects, and adverse symptoms. You will be unable to eject unless your vital signs or stress indicators exceed your parameters. Tucker, continue interviewing the HP and keep her, it, safe.
I have to get her to that room. She must show us the exhibit.
Do not allow other agents to view the exhibit, or it may cause permanent psychological damage.
Giles Corey.
Bring back proof of the dead agent.
A bleak complex of concrete buildings. Skylights dot the rooftop and the top of a large greenhouse peeking out from behind the assembly. One couldn't help but overhear the other personalities refer to this place as the zoo. It looks more like a bleak nature conservatory. The sky above is like that of a midday spring through a thick amber film, giving the area a slightly mustard yellow sheen. Tucker arrives with Hermietta. He looks warily at the personalities, making sure none get too close or too interested, and asks, "Well, here we are. Anything look or feel familiar?" As they talk, he steers them towards the greenhouse. "Yes," it says dreamily. "Same sky. I think it's in here somewhere. I don't remember the rest of this from the dream, though. I can't remember how I got into the room." Shields follows along behind the two Tuckers. He leans in towards the real Tucker and whispers something in his ear. "I'm not sure if it's anything we should reveal to Stahl. But there was a personality at the pharmacy that seemed to know her. Said he was supposed to meet her here, but He had to work. His boss doesn't like her and said that she comes in to buy needles and test kits from him. Not sure what kind, he clammed up on me. I don't know if it's important or not, but somehow I think it might be. As they approach, a crowd can be seen gathering at the front. Black iron turnstiles stand on either side of the open ticket booths. Selling the tickets are respectably dressed, uptight high schoolers, all tight-lipped smiles, dress shirts and conservative styles straight out of a 50s hygiene film. The grounds are protected by a tall, chain-link fence, topped with long swirls of razor wire. The large metal sign probably says no trespassing, in its big, red, intimidating gibberish. It appears one must buy a ticket at the front gate. Barker follows in and keeps on the other side of stall, taking in the area. He makes his way up to the ticket booth, leaning his forearm against the glass and holding up four fingers. Four tickets, please. We're in a bit of a rush, see? Barker's charms fail to ply the ticket takers. Strangely, they are quite secretive regarding the price of the tickets, but fully willing to hand them over. The agent can get the tickets, but he has no idea what he's agreeing to pay for them. Barker had them going for a second there. Even as that one vital word is misspoken, right as he loses the deal, his persistent pocket timer peals once more. 11. Seals walks out onto the street from the cafe and looks around for a payphone that hasn't been used yet. With quite a bit more confidence than he had the first time he made a call, Seals steps into the booth, picks up the receiver, and taps 0. Control, give me a .357 Ruger revolver. He adds wryly with a smirk, oh, and maybe do some research on how agents might be able to materialize with weapons already in their possession by default. Following Seals to the street side, Chaffer waits patiently as Seals negotiates with Control and assumes the guise of Giles Corey. Corey loiters on the street's obsequious splendor and lights a cigarette. The line is open.
No problem, Agent. I transfer your call.
There's a brief pause followed by a click as a second line comes on. Seals says, hello, I...
Seals? Agent Snyder here.
Monitoring phone usage.
I don't like... Agents have used the same phone twice. I can't always tell. If we don't get a handle...
Mission may be compromised.
Goddamn static. I hope you hear me because... Oh, and... Keech's assets. It may be hard to get any... Until after your next mission.
Seals pauses as Snyder speaks in amongst the crackling. Not much is getting through. Thanks, though, Agent Snyder. We're being careful about our phone usage. He hangs up and pats his hip, grinning as he pulls open the flap of his jacket to reveal a .357 tucked snugly into his belt. He looks over at Giles and says, all right, let's do this. I'll just follow your lead and not say anything until you need me to. Personalities get pretty weird around undisguised agents, right? How are we going to deal with that with the Domingos? He walks alongside Giles as he talks, allowing the large man to lead the way to their next objective. I'm not entirely sure at this moment how the Domingos will react to your presence, says Chaffer slash Corey. They may be hostile as soon as they see you. This much I know, Mrs. Domingo was able to kill an agent by herself. I am hoping that I can convince them that you're on the take and that you're willing to show them how the device works because you're eager to participate in the festivities that they've planned. Chaffer's alter ego flicks his cigarette into a sewer. If they show you the device, keep your cool. See if we can get it out of their hands before we draw our heaters. If this thing deteriorates, trust your instincts. Control gave me their blessing in this regard. We're authorized to protect ourselves and our fellow agents. Corey leads Seals through the streets. Before long, the Domingo estate looms eerily in front of them. Barker hands the tickets out to the rest and walks away warily, unsure of what he just agreed to. He motions the others to enter the zoo, intent on following behind. Concrete corridors with low ceilings open up into larger chambers with thick, yellowed glass edifices. The layout is more like that of an aquarium or a reptile house, though only vegetable matter is apparent on the other side of the translucent walls. The displays appear to be mock-ups of various biomes, nature scenes covered in angular and oddly colored plant life, most of which is not analogous to that of modern Earth. Plaques of shifting nonsense likely describe the various flora in the areas from which they have been imported. Five large chambers dominate the complex, connected by corridors and small stairwells. At the end is a large set of ominous steel doors, beyond which filmy sunshine pours in as patrons exit into a large open garden. This rear area is more interactive, with potted plants and raised beds, as well as various unique and interesting vines. Many of the placards seem to say the same thing in a shifting, unintelligible combination of alphanumerics. A large greenhouse and two ancillary greenhouses with foggy, green-tinged glass lie at the other end of the property. Tucker leads the agents deeper into the zoo, looking around at every intersection and keeping a special eye out for any rooms that seemed restricted or hidden as he makes his way through the displays. As they near the other end of the complex, he flags down one of the other visitors and asks them, "Excuse me, can you tell me which way to the exhibit?" The personality, a hearty, deeply tanned woman in cabana pants, is aghast. Nearby patrons throw sideways glares at Tucker. "I don't know, it's by invitation only. Everyone wants to see it," she whispers. "They say they're here for the Aniro Botany display, but you can only look at so many Hungry Ghosts roses and Datura Diabolus before going mad. There are so few invitations about, nobody's sure who will get one. You wouldn't believe what people had to pay to get a peek at the exhibit. Do you have an invitation?" "No. But we're the guests of someone who does. They said they'd meet us outside the exhibit. Call me a bumpkin, but I wanted to see the ghost roses before we went in," Tucker says, laughing awkwardly for real, though not for the reason that the personality would infer. "Anyway, sorry for bugging you. Does anyone have Corey's cell number? You must, you just went out bowling with him last week." As they draw from the personality, he tries to stifle any confusion. "Ignore what I just said, it was for effect. Now, anyone know anything about invitations? I knew we should have brought Chaffer in that silver damn tongue of his. Unless one of you has an idea how to get one of these invitations without mugging someone, I think this mission just became a one-way ticket. Chaffer and Seals will find their own way out, I'm sure. So, anyone got anything on either where the exhibit is, or how to get an invite?" Shield says, "I think I might know how to get to the exhibit. And I also think that the Domingos might have a few tickets to it. Unfortunately, I'm not sure if we could manage to get the tickets from them. And Chaffer and Seals are already working them and may have to eject as soon as their part of the mission is complete." Shields cannot source any more tickets to the exhibit. As for the location of the event, Shields manages to find what other agents had overlooked as a service entrance. The large sign bordered in red with violet filigrees, undulating gobbledygook denoting some grand happening, is unobtrusively set behind bright green plastic ferns.
I think I'm starting to remember,"
the HP sputters, going weak at the knees for a moment. Personalities pushed carelessly by Tucker's clone, unsympathetic or somehow unaware of its plight. Shield says, "The exhibit is deep blue. I can get in, but I doubt that anyone else can. I'll be back as quickly as I can, and if we get separated, I'll meet you all back on the streets." With that, Shields quickly heads through the small door, invitation in hand. Agent Shields does indeed have an invitation, a small letter sealed in amber wax, which he withdraws before pushing easily through the door. Yet, just beyond, there is resistance. In a flash, Shields is pushing against immense weight, shoulders pulsing, trying to pull himself through as a dozen needles pierce him at the inner elbow, calf, chest, and face. Some part of the letter's essence begins to lull him back into a more grounded reality on the other side of the door a moment later. Although the other personalities take no notice, the agents can see Shields begin to stutter out of focus as he crosses the threshold. With a small lug, Barker's watch hand approaches the 12th interval. The HP walks towards the door, following Shields with its head down and its hands in its pockets. Tucker orders Barker, "Keep her safe," and dashes after Shields, trying to intercept him. Shields nods, taking a deep breath as he steps onto the driveway of the manor, a tasteful, anachronistic mansion in the affluent neighborhood known as the Heights. Arriving from the city street, Seals tugs on his suit jacket a bit to straighten it out as he follows Giles through the door. Oddly, the wrought iron gate, though shut, is unlocked and easily slipped through. If one's sense of time is at all accurate, it's been about half an hour or so since Giles Corey / Agent Schaffer left this same house. The salesman is to meet them at their home in an hour and a half. For now, the door looks to be locked, the windows steel-shuttered from the inside. "Well, time has played tricks on me," says Corey. "I thought I'd killed more time than I actually did." He ponders around to see if the Delgados are approaching from the street. "Their absence might provide us with an opportunity to get the drop on them. We could possibly attempt to gain egress to their home and see if we could locate the Lacuna device. What do you think, Agent Seals? Are you up for a bit of B&D? Seals turns a bit, his expression troubled as he hears something. Chanting can be heard, subtle at first, but now growing, from outside of the gate. "Yeah, I think so, but do you hear that?" He looks through any crack or opening in the gate that he might find, hoping to get a better idea of what's going on. In the yard across from the manor, three skinny, turbaned men, cross-legged on their respective blankets, bring flutes to bear over a large wicker basket. As they begin to play, lithe, shapely belly dancers unfold from somewhere behind them, finger cymbal percussion slowly growing louder as they move with the music. "Weird," Seals mumbles in confusion. "Is this that little party they were going to throw?" He trails off, tilting his head and grinning a bit with a raised eyebrow as he watches the belly dancers. "What in the bloody hell is going on over there?" Corey peers through the gate at the strange soiree going on across the street. "I've seen it all," he says. "The only thing missing is a whirling dervish. Can't tell if they've noticed us yet, but it might afford us some cover if I try to jimmy our way through the front door." "Good to know that you're as confused as I am about the little party there," Seal says. "I've got an idea," his tone becoming quieter as the two walk towards the front door. "If we get caught, act like you were actually trying to apprehend me and bring me in to force me to show them how to use the device. I don't know if that was part of your original plan, but it'll be good for the situation here. They don't know you're an agent, right? If so, the little ruse should make sense. Just make sure they don't kill me," he says wryly. "Anyway, that should be a good enough cover story to buy us time if we get unlucky." He approaches the front door, looking around to see if there is any hint of an alarm system or guards or anything else of the sort. If all is clear, he goes up to the door and turns the knob to see if it is as negligently unlocked as the gate is. The door is locked, at least a mortise lock and a deadbolt. The windows have been shuttered from within. At first glance, there appears to be no alarm system. It's possible that one or more windows upstairs is not fully secured, though it would be difficult to safely ascend the large home with its multiple steepled roofs. Attempting to find a more clever point of entry would require a very keen mind. Otherwise, this place is Loctite.
"Stop! You can't go in there!"
Shield stops when Tucker grabs him.
"What? One of us has to check out the exhibit, and I'm the only one with a pass to get in. I suggest you stay out here with your twin and try to figure out what else we have to do."
Tucker says, "You're right about that. But when my twin and I were talking, it became known to me that Control had assigned me to be the only agent to witness the exhibit. The consequences of additional agents seeing it is extreme psychological damage. I was going to tell you when we got here, but you darted off." Tucker relinquishes his grip on the man's shoulder and smooths out the wrinkle he left in his suit. "And at least as long as this mission is active, I'm Deep Blue.
If the invite isn't transferable, then I'll have to punch my way in. Not ideal, but there's a first time for everything. You and Barker will guard the doors, buying as much time as you can, and then ejecting when things get too hairy. If things stay calm out here, you can try to support Seals and Chaffer once I've been inside long enough to accomplish the mission. Hermietta has to come inside with me, and keep an eye on Barker for me. Ejecting isn't his strong suit. Tucker claps shields on the shoulders. Sorry to spring it all on you, but this is how Control wants it. If you want to take it up with them after ejection, I'll have your back. Barker grunts, staying near Stahl and watching the exchange between the two. He clearly doesn't like any of this. He studies his watch, his other hand in his pocket. He taps his foot restlessly. It's 12, you two, he says sternly, keeping them up to date. Barker glances around, examining the personalities carefully, gauging their reaction to everything. He shifts uneasily. His device has yet to even make the 6 o'clock mark on a conventional pocket watch, the halfway point. The crowd seems to have thinned, if anything. Not a worry. We're all but done, Tucker reassures him. Shields thinks for a moment before nodding. If you're Deep Blue, the ticket is probably for her. Take it and let's see if it transfers over, then let's get this job done. Shields pulls the ornate, amber-sealed invitation out and hands it over to Tucker. I have my own, the HP says, producing its own sealed envelope. That leaves one of you. Choose wisely, it says dramatically. Barker takes a moment to study the hostile personality. His sunglasses shield his feelings as he peers at her for a moment. Barker nods his head in an upward motion, calling the attention of the others by stepping forward. If we have two, and Tucker has clearance, and we're supposed to document the exhibit with Stahl, then those two should go in. Barker pulls out his watch, keeping half an eye from behind his sunglasses, peering at the crowd. I'm going to hang on to this. If this starts spiking, I'm coming in. Not sure what it means if it does, but I don't like the idea of you going in there alone, he says, looking at Tucker, sighing briefly. In the meantime, I'll keep an eye on the crowd, make sure they don't start trying to cut our hair, if you follow my drift, he says, glancing at them again. Barker shakes his head dismissively, perhaps somewhat in frustration. Well, at least if anything happens, I know I can trust myself to think and act on my feet. Tucker accepts the invitation. Thanks, Shields. He turns and listens to Barker, and grins at the haircutting reference. We'll have our words in the waiting room, if not on the outside. If you want to chew me out for not informing you sooner, be my guest, but the rest is on Control. And with that, he takes Tucker too and heads inside. Finding the doorknob to be uncooperative, Seals looks up at the house. Well, let's see here, he says, rubbing his hands together in a sense of challenged anticipation, as if he's strangely happy to do extra work. Being in the zone will do that to you. He begins investigating around the outside of the house, a light tap on a seemingly suspicious blank wall here, a shifting of dirt or bushes to look for trapdoor handles there, a cellar door maybe, or a stray ladder from maintenance on the house. Whatever the entry, he throws himself entirely into the task of finding it. I like the way you think, Agent, Corey smiles, and looks furtively to the right and the left, hoping to spot the Domingos before they're spotted. He follows Seals' lead and checks the bottom floor for a hidden entryway, an unlocked window, a cellar door, etc. The agents nearly bump heads, discovering an unlocked cellar door. A more distant and less sure means of entry is the slightly open shutter, a rear-facing window on the steep roof of the building's third story. Well, we have egress, says Corey, smiling. Excellent, Seals says, quietly lifting the cellar door open. He puts his hand on his hip, as if to reassure himself that the revolver is still there, slowly and quietly descending into the cellar to see what he can see. The lights are off, and the agents must count on threadbare light from the open doorway to guide them. Within is a basement full of musty clothes, furniture, and cheap gewgaws from the 19th century. It is a veritable maze of junk opening into the basement at large.
A furnace roars in one corner, filling the immediate area around it with a faint orange haze. Seals absently rubs his jaw as he looks around. Leans over to Giles, whispering, "Did they give you any idea where they might have been keeping the device? I certainly don't know where to start looking." "I think we should start in the master bedroom. I have a hunch that it's there. For all I know, it may still be pinned to the dead agent." Corey searches for a stairwell. He turns and says, "Be forewarned. The bedroom reeks of death." Creaking wooden stairs terminate at a swollen, rotting oak door. Best guess is this door leads into the manor proper. The door still feels solid, but its rusty latch nearly comes off as it's tugged. A simple square of metal holds the latch in place. The now cliché keyhole opening with its round top and outward taper at the bottom, expecting a skeleton key that's likely lost or rusted away. Although this door is locked, a well-placed shot could easily break the antiquated locking, allowing entry within. It would also ruin their last chance at a subtle break-in. "Ah, crap," Seals whispers. "Looks like we're gonna have to make a lot of noise to get past this door. Think we should try to climb up the windows outside? They may not even be home," he says contemplatively. His train of thought shifting, he puts his ear to the door and holds his breath, becoming as motionless as possible as he listens. He puts all of his focus into listening and finding out if maybe, just maybe, he could actually sense other presences in the house in this dream world. With nigh inhuman focus, Seals takes in the entirety of the house. Not a rat nor anything else can be heard crawling within, though with every breeze the place creaks ominously. A very, very slight scratching sound can be heard at the front door. It's difficult to tell whether somebody's using a key or picking a lock, but someone is definitely trying to come through the front door, and they're trying to be quiet about it. By the agent's estimate, they still have approximately 1 hour and 15 minutes left. Barker turns to Shields, leaving the two Tuckers to do their thing, straightening himself up and shrugging his suit to a more comfortable settle. "I'm sorry, Shields. Not sure what else we can do at this point. This is the second time Tucker will be going somewhere alone, and we have to let him be. I don't like it, and I have a few words to mince with him and more likely Snyder. But we can't deviate. Too much is at risk, especially if what Tucker said about our psychological state is accurate." Barker cricks his neck a bit, pulling a hand from his pocket and flicking his hat. "Whatever you do, don't wander far. Or communicate before you do anything. Maybe we can get a hold of Chaffer and Seal somehow," he says, looking around for a phone. There's an itch detectives get when something is afoot. Barker can't help but take an extra look around, but that particular itch remains unscratched. There's something bothering him about this place. The watch strikes 13. It's as if his dissatisfaction, or perhaps his failure, activated the device. More personalities are sick. They lean against the walls or sit on the floor. Those who can still walk must step over others who have keeled over, unconscious or worse. Shield says, "You're right. We'll keep watch out here and hope those Tuckers manage to do whatever they need to do in there."
Seals opens his eyes after a moment of intense concentration.
"Interesting," he says curiously. He turns to Giles. "Somebody's at the front door trying to get in. Don't know if they're using a key or a lockpick. Want to go check it out?"
He absently fiddles at his revolver with one hand. A flash of inspiration enters Seals' eyes.
"Hey, I'll stay out of sight, but I'll listen. If it happens to be the Domingo, show up like you were just kind of admiring the view around the house, right? Then tell them about the weird party you saw across the street. Take them over there. And while you've got them occupied, I'll shoot this lock off, go in and find the device. How's that sound?"
There's too much fuss at the front door for keys to be involved. There's scratching and tiny dings from various instruments working the tumblers into position. An intruder steps into the house with the light, easy patter of a practiced thief. Corey slash Chaffer is somewhere in the darkness below, but Seals can't see or hear him.
"I'm here, Seals," says Corey.
Perhaps I should see if the intruder left the front door open. If so, perhaps I could try to get the drop on him. Wait here. If things start going badly, force the door down. Corey creeps down the stairs and heads through the cellar, towards the door as quickly and quietly as possible. As Corey heads outside, nearing the front of the property, the sound of desperate, dissonant chanting in a language obtuse to any known syntax emanates from across the street. Corey takes full advantage of the noise to muffle his advance. He makes sure his sidearm is easily accessible as he moves forward. Seals, experiencing a sudden urge that he hasn't had yet, pulls out a cigarette and lights up while he waits. He draws his revolver and fiddles with it idly, slowly turning the cylinder and listening to the crisp little clicks, occasionally glancing at the door. From the vantage point of the front doorway, Corey/Schaffer can see that it's an older gentleman in a black suit. With broad sweeps, the intruder shines a whale oil lamp about, offering only a broad back and a loping gait with which to identify him. Slowly, determinedly, he begins to ascend the stairs into the foyer. Corey moves forward several paces and, drawing his sidearm, points it at the stranger's back and says, "Not another step, mate." He hopes he's loud enough that Seals heard him. From a heretofore unseen spot, Javier Domingo appears, rapier in hand. "Surprise," he says. With inhuman alacrity, he attempts to give Barker a painfully wide neck smile. For Barker, even as he fends off Javier's dancing blade, his watch reaches its 14th interval. "I've got one of those," Javier says, regarding the watch. "I'll add it to my collection once I've gutted you, jolly sir." Swish, swish, goes the blade. Barker whips his head around to face the attacker, clearly and visibly startled. Barker staggers back helplessly, his hat flying off loosely. He falls onto his behind, gagging, grasping at his neck frantically to mend the hopefully light wound. Seals slowly lets out a plume of smoke through his lips as he pauses and listens, his gun fiddling ceasing. The shoulders relax, forcing the light to sway. The man takes a deep breath to compose himself. Very slowly he turns, eyes twinkling in the darkness. A slightly overweight man in a black suit greets Corey/Chaffer's persona. "You've got my attention," he says. The lamp raises, illuminating a round, jovial face with a thin gray comb-over, a man in his 60s. His suit looks awfully familiar, sans the tiny question mark badge. For some reason, Corey/Chaffer suddenly thinks of flowers and dour men in suits. Seals hurries out of the basement and jogs around to the front, entering the door and coming to a halt at Giles's side. He slowly raises his revolver to aim at the unknown intruder so as to add to the intimidation factor of the situation. "Looks kind of familiar, though," he thinks to himself, taking a drag on the cigarette. "Looks familiar, but I can't place him," whispers Corey, taking a few steps back and kicking the front door closed and locking it. Leaving Seals to block the intruder's direct route of escape, Corey moves left and stands perpendicular to Seals, all the while keeping his Luger pointed at the gray-haired man. With a practiced ease, the old man sets his lamp at the base of the stairs and eases himself down to sit. The hands raise cautiously before locking behind his neck. With a forward lean, he scrutinizes his captors. "I wanted to find out who they've got in there," he says, exasperated. "I'm certain they've taken a prisoner, agents. My window of opportunity is rapidly closing." He squints. "Agent Seals, is that you? I'm guessing you're not a junior agent anymore. I'm sorry I missed your graduation. It seems I can only come in on certain frequencies," he says, apologetically. Seals practically drops his gun from lowering it so fast, his face going sheet white. "Oh, shh," he sputters almost comically, his cigarette launching from his mouth and bouncing to the floor. "Agent Wagner! Why do I remember you all of a sudden? Why was I pointing a gun at you? He shoves his gun back into his pants, stamping out his cigarette as he tries to regain his composure. Sorry, Agent Wagner, that was kind of in a surprise, he stammers, then looks at Giles. Put the damn gun down. This is my instructor, he mutters, more embarrassed than irritated. Can I put my hands down? Wagner asks. Maybe bum a cigarette off of you. I can't seem to make my own anymore. Cautiously, he lowers his hands to his lap. He eyes Corey warily, unsure whether it's quite safe. Salesman. Very effective cover here in Blue City. Were you trained by Miner or Baxter? You're the only ones who are really at home in this place. Myself, anything I've learned was by accident. One thing I did learn was to keep moving. I want to find the missing agent as much as you do. Let's continue this little interrogation on the move. Corey melts away and is replaced by an incredulous chaffer. The dour agent lowers his gun immediately and says, Please accept my apology, Agent Wagner. I had no idea it was you. Chaffer moves forward and hands Wagner a cigarette. He lights his own after lighting the old man's. The body of their captor is upstairs in the bedroom closet. Saw with my own eyes. Perhaps we should head to the bedroom, sir. He pauses and then says, Miner was my instructor, by the way. Yeah, we should get a move on. No idea when the Domingos might get home early, Seal says, having regained his composure. He looks at Chaffer with a nod and says, Lead the way. Wagner gladly accepts the cigarette. He smokes thoughtfully for a moment. So, we haven't ID'd the body? By the look of you, I can't imagine you're more than three dives in. Mostly blue clearance, maybe with some deep blue mixed in if you're nosy. Well, Control landed this poor bastard Barker right in the middle of black. How I get into it is a long story. Let's save it for later. Skipping ahead. So, the Domingos throw this Barker kid in a steamer trunk and drive off with him. I pursue on foot, but I stop short of the house, distracted. I always watch for the little things, and this time, the little thing is the gardener trimming half the flowers off their stems. The guy keeps looking around, doing a little work, looking around like he's got some other angle. The last thing I remember, I lock eyes with the kid, and all I'm seeing is a long, glossy centipede eating a rat inside a pizza box. That's it. Could have been days or even months ago, I have no idea. With a start, he stands back up. Let's get on with this. Determinedly, he ascends the stairs, withdrawing a switchblade from one sleeve or the other in a quick flourish. Chaffer looks at Seals, and a wry smile spreads across his face. He follows Wagner up the stairs. Barker grasps at what's left of his throat. A long gap of an inch or more runs from ear to ear, his worried fingers following the long, smooth opening. Warmth runs down his wrists, pouring from his elbows to his shoes. Blood gushes, loudly splashing on the hard floor in front of the door to the exhibit. Goddamn watch just clicked again. It smarts as it slaps Barker's thigh on its way to 15. In comparison, Barker's surgically sliced throat tingles as if he's recently shaved. Despite the damage apparent, Barker feels quite intact. There is no real need for air. Even his voice remains unaffected. In order to kill him, Javier would have to literally chop him to pieces. For his part, he seems quite willing to chop Barker into pieces. Tough as nails, eh? Javier taunts. Let's see what you've got. Barker growls and scoops his hat up, planting it firmly on his head with a renewed vigor and tilting it downwards in an aggressive posture. He ignores Javier's taunts and springs to his feet, diving right into him with a superhuman pounce, hoping to plow the air right from his lungs and send him sprawling. Barker grasps at the sword and makes an attempt to hurl it away, if the force of the assault hadn't already thrown it from his grip. The weapon clatters to the floor. He grips Javier's collar and balls a fist, his sunglasses bearing down a harsh glare onto his opponent. Instead of concentrating on harming the personality, Agent Barker opts to disarm him. He waits, not wanting to throw another punch yet, waiting to see what he'll do when helpless.
Javier meets Barker's gaze through the dark shades, uncertain of what his opponent is capable of.
Okay, you've got, and I've seen. That was rude of me. I wouldn't fault you for trouncing me, at least a little, he says, almost hopeful at the prospect.
When Javier sees that Barker doesn't intend on beating him up, he seems disappointed. He quickly changes strategies.
Let us negotiate. I want the woman, a Hermietta Stahl. I'm willing to pay quite handsomely.
Barker makes no movement, still keeping his fist clenched and ready. What you have to offer me isn't anything I'm interested in. Why did you attack us? To get to Stahl? I'll hardly entertain your wishes now, he growls, remaining stern.
Javier says, Doubtful you would anyway. You people always want one person above all else, at the cost of all else. And there's no taking that one person from you without a fight. Hence I attacked.
It should be a foregone conclusion.
His eyes sparkle madly. Besides, we know you, Agent Barker. You've been to our home. We had a little talk, you and me and fair, sweet Cassandra. You had so many interesting things to tell us. Cassandra was rather disappointed you caved in so quickly. How she relishes torture.
Barker glares at him for a few moments, hesitating. He remembers the basement.
Well, clearly I'm not caving right now, am I? Torture will not be part of your activities today, nor will Stahl.
Barker studies Javier's face, narrowing his eyes behind his sunglasses. He lowers his fist.
Why do you care anyway? Maybe you did capture me. I don't care. I can outmatch you now, whatever the case. This time I'll do the questioning. You clearly know us, as if you studied us. Why chase us? Why torture one of us for information? Why come after Stahl? Is it just interesting, intriguing? What merit is there aside from games? Or do you have a larger focus? Yes, you've clearly grown. Your tone strikes me as accusatory. Perhaps you forget, for whom is the visitor and whom is the citizen? We have many, many friends here in our beloved city, and you people are very intrusive by nature, Javier iterates in his defense. We've seen much of you and your workings. It's difficult to understand, alien to us, but we've managed to sort enough out to be suspicious. And yes, intrigued. Everyone's got a skeleton in their closet, we can sympathize, but we are not sympathizers. Javier takes a moment to straighten out his jacket, undershirt, and tie. We had merely a passing interest in you. Someone made us a lucrative offer, if we could fetch Stahl. So here we are to fetch Stahl. I don't pretend that I had a noble reason, nor a more vital need of her. Just my part in a lucrative backroom deal. In the distance, a woman in a grand golden dress approaches, trailing tassels behind her. From here, her face seems indistinct, but shiny, perhaps painted or masked. Personalities mindlessly step aside, closing again in her wake. Barker hauls Javier to his feet and shoves him away. He makes to grab the rapier before Javier can do much in case he tries to attack again. Then get lost, pal. You're not getting me, or Stahl, or anyone else. If I see you again, I'll take that as an invitation to be less gracious. Of course. Here, Javier says, offering a blue velvet handkerchief bearing unreadable initials. You're bleeding all over the place.
Drops from his fingers, floating to the ground at Barker's feet. Barker looks to the lady in the dress approaching, steeling himself. She must be someone worth taking carefully. Likely his wife. He looks over his shoulder at the exhibit entrance, waiting a moment and hoping to hear or see something from Tucker. He glances back and adjusts his sunglasses. He waits.
Thank you. Greetings, junior agents. I had the weirdest dream last night. You never know if a dream is going to be something relatively benign and banal, or if you'll be helping a crew of aliens, of which you suddenly are one, adjust the sails on a melting chromatic space catamaran as it slingshots around a star to launch out into the depths of space. What's really going on at the border between our inner world and our day-to-day lives? There are a few theories as to why we dream. One is that we're practicing for the unexpected, which would go a long way to explaining why dreams are so weird. Another is that what we experience doesn't make complete sense because it's more of a side effect of our brains organizing our day-to-day experiences, or even the stimulation of the part of our brain that processes visual data so it won't atrophy overnight. So maybe we shouldn't take them so seriously and just consider this an opportunity to have a little fun every night. There's also the idea that we're actually interacting with the unconscious aspects of ourselves, even a part of us that can only communicate through symbols. And it's the unraveling of these symbols that tells us who we really are. Carl Jung suggested these aren't just things we've learned in our lifetime, they're inherent symbolic representations that we share collectively in a way that science hasn't gotten around to explaining just yet. James Watson was trying to figure out the shape of DNA with Francis Crick, both likely influenced by the work of chemist Rosalind Franklin. Yet the breakthrough is often attributed to the night James Watson saw the double helix shape in a dream. Supposedly, René Descartes dreamed of an angel who told him the conquest of nature is to be achieved through number and measure. That's why we call him the Math Daddy. I mean, the father of modern mathematics. Mary Shelley based Frankenstein on a dream. And without her dream, it's likely we would not have the genres that we call horror in science fiction as we know them today. One time, I had a dream that I met the star of Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Richard Dreyfuss. I don't remember what we talked about in the dream. What I do remember is waking up the next morning, getting in the car to go to work, and turning on the radio right when the announcer said, "And next, we're going to meet Richard Dreyfuss." Here's another weird coincidence. If you just realize that you like Lacuna Slowburn so much you'd like to support this and other projects, you can do so at Patreon. Join us as we expand our influence over the unsuspecting masses. You'll get access to all my classified materials and a bunch of stuff I made up. Because let's be honest, it's all the same thing, really. Discover things the public just isn't ready to know. Experience the thrill of fictionally endangering yourself on a daily basis. Enjoy a constant state of paranoia with none of the calories. Get bonuses, exclusive materials, early releases, live broadcasts, and more at patreon.com/DonFathom. That's DonFathom. We're on social stuff, too. Check it all out. We're Midnight Police on YouTube, TikTok, and X. We also have a Facebook group with the same name. We're on Threads, too, though we're not sure what it really does yet. On Instagram, we are The Midnight Police. That is The Midnight Police. Get it right. You've been warned. This week's episode was written by Don Fathom, Matt Kimmel, Ian Bloom, and entities working under the pseudonyms Agent Chaffer, a.k.a. Older Cloud, Agent Seals, and Agent Shields. Today's episode was read by Don Fathom and Ian Bloom. Production, editing, music, sound effects, pretty much everything else was by me, Don Fathom. I also remix a few public domain songs, which at some point will make it into the show notes. All content from Lacuna Part 1, Second Attempt is copyrighted Memento Mori Theatrics, all rights reserved and whatnot. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 license. Quick review, agents, that means you can copy and distribute Lacuna Slowburn under the following conditions. Refrain from changing or using it for commercial purposes and give us appropriate credit. Otherwise, we'll send the Spider-Man after you. Or something even worse. Lawyers. That's all for this week, Junior Agents. See you the next time you fall asleep. If you can still fall asleep after hearing me say that.